Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
It's budget day. We have all the headlines, top lines, and landmines coming up in this special edition of the New Statesman podcast. Hello and welcome to our special budget day, extra special emergency podcast. We are joined by a great guest. We're joined by Hara Davis, who was appointed as chairman of the Royal Bank of Scotland on the 1st of September 2015. He's formerly worked at the Bank of England, the CBI, and the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, and is the author of 5 books focused on the financial market. So, hello, Howard.
Hi.
What were your initial impressions of the budget? Just as soon as he sat down, what did you think about what Philip Hammond had said?
I thought it was a reasonable stab at treading through the minefield in which he found himself. I think there is a degree of fiscal relaxation, which is probably sensible given that growth is expected to be lower, but not sufficient fiscal relaxation to frighten the horses in financial markets, which are nervous at the moment, particularly given the imminence of some kind of hard Brexit. So I think overall, I would say that the balance looks reasonable to me. I would say, however, it's an iron rule of budgets that any budget that looks good at first sight turns out to be a disaster later.
The wheels fall off by about 6 p.m. Just to go back to those growth figures, because that was a moment when I was following along on Twitter when there was a kind of a sharp collective intake of breath. So the OBR, which is an independent agency, has forecast down all growth expectations. And I think for the whole forecast period, it's now all of it is below 2%, which is unprecedented. And Philip Hammond very much strongly linked that to poor productivity, which is a long-term problem in Britain. What did you make of those figures?
This is the ghost of George Osborne stalking the corridors of Westminster still, because he put in place the OBR. Of course, during his time, generally it wasn't particularly disruptive because we were in the middle of a big crisis and everyone could see that, and therefore the OBR's forecast didn't cause him a big issue. They have, for 16 consecutive budgets or autumn statements, maintained the previous view about productivity in the UK economy and have finally decided that that is no longer plausible. So it's a rather sudden change. And I think that's a bit tough on Philip Hammond, because you would have normally expected these forecasts to be kind of shaded down over a period, but they've done a major reforecasting. So that created quite a significant issue for him. It does look to me as if we have moved to a lower productivity trajectory. It's hard to produce a good explanation as to why that is the case. There may be some issues about delayed investment, poor education and training record, but none of them really explain a change of trend quite in the way we have. However, if that's the way it is, we have to get used to it. And we can't keep on assuming that higher productivity is going to dig us out of a growth hole. So I think at least we have a prudent baseline on which to do the budget arithmetic.
Well, I think the interesting thing, partly in terms of one of your sort of old employees, is then I think the unnoticed thing in the last Monetary Policy Committee report was their argument for having a hike, which was effectively then lower productivity, lower growth, is the norm post-Brexit. And then actually what might look to us as a weak economy is actually probably as good as it gets. The irony, of course, is I'm at the moment midway through Fallout, which I'm reviewing for a later issue of the NS.
I'd like to clarify that's Tim Shipman's book about the Brexit campaign, not the video, yes. The excellent video game Fallout, which is what confused me when you said this morning.
And it reminded me of something and I had known before, but I had forgotten, which was that Philip Hammond was, one of the things he was derided for by Nick Timothy was his belief that Brexit would reduce growth in 2017 to 1%. And blah, what has happened is growth is now forecast to be a little bit over 1%. So I think, in an odd way, I think it feels to me the big story of this budget, despite him kind of doing the obligatory conservative kneel before the Brexit God kind of thing, is that Brexit has hurt our long-term growth.
Well, that's going to be a big, big old row, isn't it? Because I thought it was very notable how the pretty much, I think, the first announcement that Philip Hammond made was the £3 billion for Brexit contingency planning, which was an obvious kind of sop to people who said that he's, you know, not on board with it, he's not making the preparations necessary. I don't know how you felt about his attitude towards Brexit. And, I mean, apart from that, he tried very much not to mention it after some front-loading some sort of sunlit uplands at the top.
Well, I think that we've already talked about the problems created by Osborne's creation of the OBR, but there is an advantage, which is that Hammond himself does not have to hang his hat on any particular revised forecast about the impact of Brexit. He just says, that's what they think the economy is going to go. He doesn't even need to say why they think that. Part of that is, I think, a post-Brexit effect, lower exposure to free trade and therefore on the whole a lower growth rate. Most economists would argue that's probably true. But he doesn't need to get into that. He just needs to take it as his baseline and work from there. I think probably it makes sense for him to do a budget without too much reference to Brexit, apart from this initial £3 billion. I don't know what that's going to be spent on, by the way, but maybe tarmacking Kent in order to put all the lorries, that possible. But more seriously, I suppose that each department does have some issues that they probably need to spend money on. But I think it's probably sensible for him to avoid Brexit, because Brexit is important, in my view, but it isn't everything. You know, Brexit, before Brexit, people were finding it difficult to buy new houses, and they are finding it difficult after Brexit. So I think it makes sense for him to steer clear of that.
Well, let's talk a bit about the house building, because that was saved to the end to be, you know, we always talk about the idea of a Brexit rabbit, and I think it went down extremely well in the chamber. I mean, Stephen, you were there. That was the moment I think the Tory MPs really... That got the biggest reception as far as I could
that
see.
That was, I think, I would say the only real cheer of the speech was from the stamp duty cut.
But my feeling about it is, I don't know whether or not it will fall apart. It reminded me a lot of, say, something like the raising of the threshold for when you pay income tax, in the sense that actually that is because of the way that the boundaries then move on, is actually much better the higher up the income scale that you go. So it's something that it looks very appealing to the particular demographic that it's targeted at, but actually it has nice effects for other people too. And that's kind of how I felt about this announcement, was that it looks like a giveaway to millennials, but actually it's a way of stabilising the housing market if you worry that their house prices are beginning to slide now, which would then make a lot of people worry and feel a bit poorer. I don't know how you feel about that, Howard.
Yeah, I've been avoiding taking calls from my two sons in their 30s because they both have bought flats in the last 3 years and they're going to be absolutely furious about this, I can tell you, because it's quite a big discontinuity. I think fundamentally it's a recognition that the government went a bit too far under previous administration in raising stamp duty and extracting more money from the housing market on stamp duty and on transfers of property rather than doing it through increasing property taxes, through increasing council tax, which in many ways would be a more logical thing to do. So they've created another rather odd discontinuity here. It is going to be a big giveaway. It was a big cheer, as you say, because he avoided, I mean, it's always interesting in a budget to note the dogs that did not bark. And the dog that didn't bark here was the student. We didn't do anything more on student loans, which many people thought he might do. So they've got cheaper rail cards, the graduates, but that's about all. So I think that it is a recognition that they went too far on it. As for what the consequence of the housing market will be, I mean, it's a fairly sizable reduction. I think it's an average of about £1,600 for every first-time buyer. And it will have an impact in London too, because of this neat idea of it going up to houses worth up to £500,000 and getting the £300,000. So it will have an impact on more expensive areas too. You know, I think probably it does make sense to do something, because I do think that they were in danger of gumming up the housing market by very large taxes on transfers. And that was actually not just preventing people from getting in, but preventing people from moving around. And as important as getting your first flat is, when you have a child or two, being able to move. And that was a big tax for most people when you move to a small house or a three-bedroom flat. So I think it probably does make some sense in the context of the housing market as a whole.
Yeah.
Were you surprised, Stephen, about there wasn't anything on demand? I mean, to make John Ellidge, who runs our sister website, Citymetric, very happy, someone at one point did actually shout out in the Commons, build more homes. And there wasn't as much, there was some talk about Oliver Letwin is going to run a review, and which I think was basically to look at things like land banking. But were you surprised there wasn't any action on supply?
I wasn't really, because a really good way to predict what's going to be in a budget is who is making a lot of noise before it. Sadia Javid would not have given a big speech that was effectively a prolonged subtweet of Philip Hammond, in which he talked about how it's nonsense to suggest that the reason why millennials can't get on the housing ladder is they eat too many avocados, if he was happy with what he thought he was going to get in the budget. And this fell far short of the 50 billion he wanted, although there's a figure similar to it, 44 billion. Sajid Javid wanted 50 billion on capital expenditure on new house building. This is 44 billion on building loans and a whole variety of packages. I want to talk briefly about the stamp duty stuff as well, because I have got the relevant page of the OBR's report.
Yep.
They have modelled it, and it is true that there are many ways in which stamp duty is not a very desirable tax, because it prevents
lumpy,
movement,
right?
And it deters a lot of behaviour than you would want to encourage in any property market. The flip side of that, though, is it does also hold prices at certain thresholds. So, one of the things that Osborne's changes did is they kind of killed the weird existence of the 249k flat because of the change to make it slightly more progressive in terms of how it was paid. This will similarly inflate prices at the 250 to 300k trend. And it's very easy to forget, because we are here in London, that is actually the overwhelming bulk of where the action is if you are a first-time buyer across the country. And they actually estimate that first-time buyers will be fairly big losers from this change.
So can I get this right? If you're saying that if you're someone selling a house and you'd be thinking about putting it on the market about 250k, you think, well, I might let that creep up a little bit because it'll be offset by people who will have a bit more money to spend because they'll get stamp duty relief.
Yes. If you feel like depressing yourself, listeners, by walking past an estate agent, you will notice that actually they do tend to cluster around effectively where the stamp duty bands used to be. That was even more clear before the 2014 changes. Although, to say something positive about George Osborne, which is rare for me on this podcast or indeed anywhere, he did successfully partially start to smother the buy-to-let market. But the interesting thing, of course, is whether or not, if there are more interest rate hikes to come, which the MPC has signalled that there are, whether or not that also spurs exits from that market. The weird thing about the whole buy-to-let industry is there's been a great deal of rent seeking, but very few of the people who have been rent seekers have extracted a great deal of rent themselves, right? There are weirdly a lot of fairly precarious buy-to-let landlords.
So you mean people who put it into their own mortgage,
yeah, they put it into their own mortgage. So the one of the difficulties is you need a way for those people to exit the sector, but you need them to do it in a way which doesn't create a disorderly...
One thing I thought was a good policy, and who knows if I will be debunked by this by tea time, was the 100% council tax premium on empty properties, which a lot of people went, well, ho-ho, actually anyone who can afford to keep a property empty, that's not going to make any difference to them, which seems to me the kind of perfect kind of policy, really, because then they'll just pay some money. It reminded me a little bit of George Osborne's, I think it was a capital gains on foreign investors. And basically, if you've got a group of people who've got loads and loads of money and you don't really want them to act in a particular way, then you win either way. Howard, was there anything else that you immediately thought, oh, that's good,
one,
I like that?
Is pretty justifiable, I think. There are not that many. I mean, the number of second homes is actually falling at the moment, and so it probably isn't going to raise a vast amount of money, but it will raise some. I think that's quite good. I mean, I think we should recognise the rise in the national living wage, because that has gone up by over 4%. So once again, the bottom 20% of the income distribution are going to do better, will have a small real terms increase after inflation. And, I think one has to say that's good. And I think they've carried on with that policy. What is interesting, again, on the dog that didn't bark thing, is that there isn't really that much here for the dreaded squeeze middle or the just about managing we used to hear quite a lot about. But of course, they're very expensive to help because a lot of them.
I thought that was really interesting when you looked at the distributional impact that actually it was quite a progressive government.
It is.
In terms of the lowest getting more and the highest losing more. But again, the other people I thought the dogs that didn't bark was pensioners, which is a really, I don't think I've actually heard the P word mentioned at all.
No.
And now obviously the Tories went into this election promising an end to the triple lock, which got ditched very quickly after as part of their deal with the DUP. But there weren't any sweeties for pensioners or really particularly older people generally, as far as I could see.
Well, I think probably just about the news that pensioners have actually been doing relatively well because they've had increases, they've had the triple lock, etc., has sort of got through into political consciousness. You won't find many MPs saying pensioners are all terribly well off, so nothing should be done. But on the other hand, the level of pressure for something to be done for pensioners is not that great. And after all, they got Brexit, which was what they voted for.
Well, that's true. That's a pretty big sweetie, if that's what you want. Stephen, was there anything in there that you thought, well, this is a really good idea? This is not something I would have thought.
I did like the minimum wage increase. Actually, kind of, that's an interesting area. It's always useful to mark the things you've got wrong. I was fairly sceptical that Osborne's abandoning of the tripartite model of setting that wage. I thought that would probably create more job losses and disruption at the lower end of the labour market than it has. It has actually been a success. It is the biggest percentage increase in terms of the take-home pay of the lowest.
When does it become a problem, for example, for councils paying care workers?
So the bad news is it is already incredibly acute for councils paying care workers. And the interesting thing that Philip Hammond did not do in this budget, so there was a court case recently where care home workers who live in with someone with acute care are now have to be paid to sleep. Effectively, there were some people who, if you were there overnight and you had the idea that you could be woken up for some reason or another because of the person you were looking after might need your care, you were paid a third of the minimum wage for the hours you were sleeping. The court has ruled, I think, completely correctly, that seeing as you've been taken out of your home, you can theoretically be woken at any hour and you're having a disrupted sleeping pattern. Mm-hmm. Of course you are working, and this idea that for the hour you're awake you should only be paid a third of the minimum wage is fictional. However, that is a massive increase in the costs for local authorities and the charities they mostly pay to do this work for them. That is also going to, that as well as that increased cost, you've got the increased cost of the minimum wage increase. The government basically keeps going, okay, we're aware we've got this problem, so we'll just ignore it for now. That is a big problem. But actually, increasing the minimum wage, if an increase in the minimum wage puts pressure on government spending, that's a result of government spending decisions. The risk with a minimum wage hike where you abandon the low pay commission and its model of getting economists, trade unionists and businesses to set a rate isn't you do it at a level than private companies go to the wall, right? So actually the area of the economy to watch out for with the wage increase was catering, where you have very low margins, say a restaurant which employs three people. Whether or not a lot of those went to the wall, they didn't, actually. That, in some ways, has been...
Which is, I guess, a repetition of a lesson from the original minimum wage, which was, you know, blood-curdling predictions from William Hague at the time that this was going to be terrifying and horrifying, and those didn't really come to pass.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Howard, on the other side, is there anything that you heard and you kind of winced a bit or thought, well, that's an odd decision or, you know, that could cause them problems?
Well, you know, in environmental terms, I find the continued freeze on fuel duty to be an odd thing. Of course, I understand the politics of it, as we all do. The white van man is very influential. But nonetheless, you know, it doesn't seem to me to make much sense to continue to freeze fuel duty. I think we need to accept that we should be making fossil fuels more expensive, and once again, we haven't done.
I thought the figures involved, off the top of my head, I think they said something like £46 billion saved by people since 2010. as a kind of hooray. But then you also thought, well, that's, I mean, in terms of deficit reduction, that would be a, I mean, that is a headline figure. There's a hell of a lot of money. So it's a very costly measure, certainly, isn't it?
To keep
cancelling that. Booze duty has also been frozen, except for Philip Hammond has declared war on strong cider. That's the one that he's really...
White cider. Yeah. Not something I drink.
No, not good, because it would be costing you a lot more. The 26 to 30 rail card seems to have gone down quite badly once people realised it was only for off-peak fares, right? So this is the problem. It's not actually for commuting. I just don't know how many... I mean, I saw Gloria DiPiero tweeting, well, actually lots of people in my constituency get the bus, which is a consistent theme whenever we talk about rail and things like that, about actually the number of people who don't use rail, and actually that tends to be more of a middle class and higher income
thing.
Well,
I'm about to get my Christian Woolmar on, right?
I completely
agree. This idea that, so we've decided pollution is fine if you are doing the pollution for your business needs. Yeah, it's ridiculous, and White Van Man is going to be exempt from it. And I mean, I don't understand why Hammond decided to walk into the punch of making comments about driverless cars again. It's like, mate, your government is the driverless car. Don't do this to yourself. But
his other jokes weren't too bad, though, Stephen. Are you going to forgive him at least for a couple of these jokes?
Driven, if you'll forgive the unintentional words, we are being driven to this future of driverless cars, and we ought to be aiming for a carless future. We ought to be making it much cheaper and more pleasant to use public transport, particularly buses, because in large parts of the country that is a more effective form of transport, because unfortunately successive governments have built around the car, so you can't just seamlessly move to railways. And in the long term, railways and other systems of public transit. And it also is a lot of money that has been foregone since 2010. I think that is probably the biggest missed opportunity. The weird thing is I can't spot anything that is going to be a problem for the government in terms of passing this. The stamp duty stuff, which I think is a mistake, doesn't matter to the DUP because there are very few homes in Northern Ireland which are going to get anywhere close. I mean, at the point you're paying stamp duty, almost you live in a palace.
You're saying your homes in Northern Ireland are already pretty much exempt from stamp duty.
So that doesn't create political problems in the same way, particularly at the 5,000 N, where they think it's going to create 500,000, where they think it's going to create some bunching issues. Also, the DUP's electorate is a lot poorer than the Conservative one, so it again, it's just not an electoral issue in the same way. And the Conservative MPs like it. So I can't really see anything in this budget that is going to become a running sore.
I float my terrifying thesis, which is that it does feel like quite a giveaway budget. And you know when giveaway budgets traditionally happen?
For elections. I mean, it's only $23 billion, right? It's not.
Yeah, I mean, normally this should have been a tax-raising budget. If we hadn't voted for Brexit and the economy was still growing at 2 or something percent, then this would have been the time to have made a big change. So it is a very different budget from the one that we would have got had Osborne still been there. But let's not overstate the giveaway. I mean, it's about, in the maximum year, which is, I think, the year after next, it's about 0.4% of GDP as an increase. Well, you know, it's not nothing, but it's not massive.
OK, well, you've reassured me that we might not have an election next year, which is really all I wanted to hear at this point. Thank you very much for joining us, Howard Davies. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Helen Lewis, and my co-host, Stephen Bush. We're recorded by India Bork and produced by Caroline Crampton. Our theme music is by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons. You can follow us on Twitter at @NS_podcasts.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Trust in politics is broken, so can we get UK politics working again?
That was the last time we were happy. 2012.
I'm Beth Rigby, Sky's political editor. Join me every week with Labour's Jess Phillips and Conservative peer Ruth Davidson for some electoral dysfunction.
This idea of nuance has completely left politics. Yeah.
Together, we'll focus on the policies that could deliver political satisfaction. Follow Electoral Dysfunction wherever you get your podcasts.